Here we go. All right, we have begun. Tonight's class, Parshas Vayechi, is mocking Trump a religious duty? I would say for many Jews, 100%. Not for many Jews, for many people. I would say most of America. Okay, so let's, I'm going to not just do any example, but a very good example. We're gonna go to a good example of this is our good friend Stephen Colbert, who is basically his entire career nowadays is mocking Trump. Here we go. Hold on.
Women who have accused Donald Trump of.
Okay, we'll go back here.
Speaking of shady characters, Donald Trump. Yesterday, we heard from three of the 19 women who have accused Donald Trump of sexual misconduct. Well, this morning, the president fired back, despite thousands of hours wasted and many millions of dollars spent. The Democrats have been unable to show any collusion with Russia, so they are moving on to the false accusations and fabricated stories of women who I don't know and or have never met. And that is the absolute truth and or a complete lie. Because that is a lie. Included in the list of his accusers are a business partner, women from the Miss USA pageant, which is Trump, and a contestant in season 4 of The Apprentice. Your challenge is for me to sexually harass you, and then you having to watch me become president of the United States. Enjoy. Well, this afternoon, thank you. This afternoon, People Magazine also released a photo of Natasha Stoyanov, one of Trump's accusers, standing right next to Donald Trump. Right next to him, in what scientists call the grope zone. So, Donald Trump, you knew these women. But yesterday, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders defended the Trump.
The president has denied any of these allegations, as have eyewitnesses. And several reports have shown those eyewitnesses also back up the president's claim in this process.
How can you have eyewitnesses to say you didn't do something? Your Honor, I specifically remember seeing him not murder that man on several occasions. I rest my case. Hi-ho! Wrong guy, wrong story. I apologize. But you know, it's just too enjoyable. But you know who believes the women? The woman who led the call for Al Franken's resignation last week, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Here's what Gillibrand is saying now.
These allegations are credible. They are numerous. I've heard these women's testimony, and many of them are heartbreaking. President Trump should resign.
Okay, maybe. But for that to work, you have to be talking about somebody with a sense of dignity, okay, and a shred of decency. Donald Trump doesn't have either of those. Instead, he's got a label on the back of his neck. Warning, contains no shame. It's right below property of Vladimir Putin.
All right, you get the idea. All right, pretty, all right, let's get to the class. Let's get to some of the questions here. All right, that's a very good example of the position here. All right. Question number one to you guys. How does Stephen Colbert effectively mock Donald Trump? Okay, guys.
Well, the first thing he does is he tries to impersonate Donald Trump and speak the way Donald speaks.
Right. So he has an exaggerated impersonation of him. Correct. Mm-hmm. What else? That's it?
He makes fun of what he said, like his statements, so like how ridiculous they are.
Right. So
reasonable person would say these things when there's video and picture evidence that he's met.
Right.
Them.
So the everybody's favorite tweets, which is just an endless source of just of challenges, which are seemingly crackpot one crackpot statement after the other. So just reading him. Yes. Okay. I think that's pretty clear. What else? Okay. What is Stephen Colbert's position on of Donald Trump as president?
He doesn't like
the resistance.
What?
He's the resistance. He's anti-Trump.
Yeah, he's a big yes. He's big anti. And why is he an anti-Trumpite?
Because Stephen Colbert is very liberal.
Well, he's not saying. Well, that's not. See, that's an interpretation. He's claiming. What's his claim?
That the president's a dummy based on what he says and does.
Well, either he's foolish, or and he's a sexual molester, a harasser, and he is every negative that you can imagine, he is that.
Right.
Now, let's get a little deeper here. What are the joys of mocking a president or any leader? Now, when you're a kid, there's always satisfaction of enjoying it. There's making fun of a teacher, making fun of a principal, and by extension, any authority. What's the? There's an enjoyment of that.
Humanizes them.
What?
It humanizes them. To mock a leader points out their flaws and brings them back down to, oh, they're just like us.
Right, they're normal people, yeah.
They're just like us, problems. Or even better. They're worse than us. They're lower than us. Not just they're just like us. They're even more.
Right, it makes us feel better because we think we're better than them. Or some people do.
Right, so part of the satisfaction, enjoyment of mocking a president or any other leader is the idea of by reducing them through these types of attacks, they to remove any shred of their authority over them. They're not an authority figure. They're a big fat loser. Okay? Is that part of the enjoyment? And
yeah.
Is there others? All right, so not one factor is a person hates to have any authority over them. Another factor is them being perceived as superior makes you feel inadequate. So by mocking them, they're and shown to be less than us, they're reduced. And on top of that, I don't feel bound by their authority. So it's a double win. It's a two for Tuesday. I feel good about myself, and I don't have any authority. Win. Would you agree? Are those two clear enjoyments of mocking an authority figure, a president, a leader? Can you think of any more?
I think it gives people, I don't know how to say it, an audience. Like, the Trump lovers have found their group because they seem a bit extreme. I can't take either one, the Trump lovers and the Trump haters anymore, because Trump can do no wrong in their eyes. And it's just so pathological on both sides. And then, so it gives them their place in society to be so for something and so against something. It's now they belong to something.
Right. So you have it. So by being so either so militantly supportive of Donald Trump or so militantly against Donald Trump, it gives you sort of credit within in this particular special little society. Either the Trumper society or the never Trumper society, but it's the same thing. So it gives you also, not only does it make you feel better, make you feel removed from the authority, whether it's removed, free from the other liberal establishment or free from the tyrannical Trumper people. Either one, you're now free. It also gives you more of an audience or a further engagement and connection with this subgroup, special little community. Now, let's steer the conversation back to the Torah. Does the Torah endorse freedom of speech?
No.
How do you know that?
It's like the halakha of Lashon Hara. So
there you go.
Anything.
So, for example, Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, in other words, in America, you can't do either libel or slander. But that's based upon making up false information. But if it was true, you could publish it, right? In halacha, you cannot publish negative information for no reason. You know what I'm saying? Unless there could be a clear public good. You know, for example, for me to publish the name of a convicted sex offender, and let everybody know in the community that this person lives near the community, that's, I'm allowed to do that, even though he's a observant Jew. You know what I'm saying? So the Torah does not allow us to say anything about anybody. So are you allowed to mock President Obama or mock President Trump?
I mean, do you mean like here in the U.S. or just like, does the Torah say you can?
Well, what would the Torah say about that?
Based on what you said, it says that you can't if it's a lie. But if it's true, you can?
No, you can't. You can't say negative. Now, here's the halacha. You cannot share, Lashon Hara, which Sean brought up. Lashon Hara means is communicating negative but true information about a fellow Jew. Okay? Motzi Shemra, making up a false reputation, is sharing negative information about a fellow Jew. Now, even though technically, halachically, Donald Trump and Barack Obama are not Jewish, still, to share negative information about any person is still what they call a midah ra. It's a bad quality. You know what I'm saying? It could be, in other words, it may not be technically, halachically forbidden, but it's still a bad character trait. It still is it's still a lack of morality on your part.
Right. So you're saying, like, we can't do it just because it's wrong to do, even if it's true.
Right. There has to be, you could only bring this material up if it has some objective purpose. You know what I'm saying? So for
example, voters need to know something.
Yeah, no. For me to stand up there and mock Donald Trump on late night television would not exist in a Torah society.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, there's a term for that. The term, what Stephen Colbert does so effectively, is called, the Hebrew word is called late sanut, mocking or mockery. Okay. Late son, Hebrew, is also a clown, but late son nude is sort of a mocking, derisive speech about another person. Now, what is the limitations of Colbert's mocking of the president? Now, what is lacking? And I think Suzanne brought up a little element to it.
That he can't lie, can't just make outright lies about the president.
No, I'm saying, is there any? What's the limitations of Colbert's mocking of the president? What is, in order, let's say you hear, I only shared to you like 3 minutes of the bit. Let's say you watch the whole bit, okay?
Curse?
I'm saying, is there any limitations for you, for us the observer, us the audience?
He can't curse, he can't use certain words, right?
Well, that's his limitations because of the network. What I'm saying, is there any limitations intrinsically as a communication, as a depiction of the president?
No. He's lost his objectivity completely. So,
yeah.
Do you mean like the limitations of freedom of speech?
But Suzanne is bringing up a very important point here. She's saying that that when he's making fun of the president, you know, whatever qualities he may have, right? He no longer becomes an objective evaluator of the policies and or any of the activities of the presidency. You know what I'm saying? He's no longer a judge of the presidency, you know, in any kind of real way. He's just sitting there making pot shots. Now, this gets into the key. What is there between political satire and mocking? That's really the key question here. Who's on the 646 number?
Hi, that's Dan.
Dan Lasman. Good to hear from you. All right, so I'll ask you, Dan, what's the difference between political satire and mocking?
Well, political satire should serve some political purpose. So you're using it to highlight a policy or an injustice of the politician. Whereas mocking is, you know, can be just more of a derogatory speech or just for fun.
1,000% correct. In other words, political satire might use mocking, but they're trying to underscore the fact that there is a problem with a policy. You know what I'm saying? If a person, you know, a person makes fun of, say, the latest Republican tax plan, right? So they could be, you know, trying to highlight an injustice they might perceive, or an inconsistency, or hypocrisy, and they might use humor as that. In the United States, one of the oldest, going back to the forming of our country, one of the greatest ways of political satire was actually was the one cell cartoon. You know, the political cartoon, which had like one cell. Now, do you know why that was so powerful? Anybody know why? History question. American history question. Why was the political cartoon, you know, where all the works in like one, with it's one cartoon in one frame. Why was that, and still is, a very powerful tool of political satire?
Why was are you talking about the New Yorker?
Well, the New Yorker is the very big, it's a famous highbrow, but even you might even have it in the Post, you know, the New York Post, which is not a highbrow. Why was that so effective throughout the last 250 years in America? Anybody know? I learned this myself in preparing for the class.
It's something that the masses can all understand.
Got Shapiro on the nose. Now I can understand, but for many years, until the turn of the century, very strong percentages of the population were illiterate. Or they couldn't read the paper. They could understand a cartoon. You know what I'm saying? So it was something that had, it was a very powerful way to deliver social criticism or political criticism to everybody. Because everybody can get, even if your English is not so strong, everybody can get a cartoon. So Scott, very good on that. So, little history buff over there. All right, so this is a very
love the history channel.
Okay, so Scott, so read this little piece over here, which is actually an excellent formulation about the use of political satire. Go ahead.
See, just as only the jester can tell the king the truth, the satire performs function in democratic society by using humor to broach taboo subjects, especially in times of crisis. According to the book by Penn State researchers, robust satire is often a sign of crisis, and the ability to share and consume it as a sign of a free society, said Sophia McLean, professor of international affairs and comparative literature, the director of Penn State's Center for Global Studies. We see satire emerge when political discourse is in crisis, when it becomes important to us, comedy, to put political pressure on misfortune, folly, and abuse. Misinformation, folly, and abuse of power.
Correct. Okay, good. So basically, there is a very healthy and effective use of satire. So, you know, political cartoons is a form of that. I think really, those who study it, really, it started really in the late 60s even, but in the first year of Saturday Night Live, one of the first actors was a guy, it was Chevy Chase. How many of you guys even know him? He also went on to many, many movies. So
I know who Chevy Chase.
Very famous. So Chevy Chase, one of his big impressions of then-President Gerald Ford. Anybody know? This is a real trivia buff question.
From Saturday Night Live? From
Saturday Night Live, year one, going back to, I think, 1976, 75.
The original cast, yeah.
Original cast. So what he would you do was would just, like, just fall downstairs. Like, he would just trip over everything. Just depicting the president as a clumsy buffoon. Okay? So, you know, I don't know if Gerald Ford tripped and fell any more than anybody else did, but he sort of captured that depiction, and that in a very powerful way. That wasn't really political satire. That was just straight out political mocking, just making fun of the guy. Okay, so that's not really helpful, you know what I mean? And that, from a terror perspective, is not really allowed to do that. You know, you can't just sacrifice. In other words, how does a person feel when they're mocked?
I mean, it depends on the person. For somebody like President Trump, it just gets them really angry. So other people will just let it kind of, like, you know, flat up their back. They won't care.
People like it. Like, there's a whole, like, thing of, like, roasting somebody.
Right. There is an idea of a roast where a person...
Some people can, joke and realize that you're just busting each other's chops kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Right, so they're just, so the guys wanted to give up their, the dignity by having people just lace into them, and they'll get the 50 minutes of fame just to be, you know, powerfully and potently attacked. So the thing is like this, that's not, you know, when you embarrass somebody, if somebody said something that was embarrassing to somebody, in Judaism, what does Judaism equates embarrassment, or certainly embarrassment in public, with what activity?
It's like murder.
It is murder. It is a social.
Isn't that like a bit extreme?
No, because you're not killing them physically, but emotionally. Let's say a person's in, like visualize the classic high school situation. You're in the lunchroom, and somebody shares in public a very embarrassing piece of information or story about you in front of all your friends. So a person will blush and turn color. So literally, Talmud says, that's why if you embarrass somebody in public, you lose your portion to the world to come.
Makes sense. I get it.
Because you totally destroy the person. The person's completely crushed, devastated. So you socially killed them. You personally, you emotionally killed them. So a lot of Judaism views that being something which is very, very horrible, and an affront to the basic dignity of man, and should never be done. So mocking is not really allowed, ever. Now, okay, so I just want to give that perspective. Now, the reason why I get to this, we're going to go to sort of the other extreme. Let's take a look at the parsha. Let me have Shane Bavakasha.
And it came to pass after these things that one said to Yosef, "Behold, your father is sick." And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told Yaakov and said, "Behold, your son Yosef comes to you." And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed.
Okay, so let me give you the scene. Yaakov moved the family down to Egypt. He's been there for 17 years. He came there when he was the ripe old age of 130. And now he's about to die. He's 147. So he's living in Goshen, which is in a rural area out of the capital. Yaakov becomes sick because he's getting old. And the information gets to Yosef. So Yosef quickly comes to Yaakov to speak to him. And he brings his two sons. But what I wanted to do, now, what did Yaakov do? He's lying in bed sick. What does he do?
He sits up.
Now, the Torah, the fact that the Torah gives us that information, that little detail information, is very, very significant. Let's take a look at the Rashi. Go ahead. Read the Rashi, Shana.
And Yisrael strengthened himself. He said, "Although he is my son, he is the king, and I will do honor to him." From this, we may infer that we must show honor to a person of royal rank. Similarly, Moshe showed honor to the king when he said, "And all these, thy servants, shall come down to me." which was only a polite way of saying, thou thyself wilt be forced to come down to me.
Right. Now, that king, by the way, that king is talking about, which king is that?
Paro.
Paro, correct, the king of Egypt.
And so too did Eliyahu, and he girded up his loins and ran before Ahab.
Right. Now, both these kings, at the point of Paro, who is now oppressing the Jews, he's honoring the king. And so too, Eliyahu Hanavi is running in front of Ahab, King Ahab, who's an idolatrous king, who's certainly a very flawed character. And is showing what they call Kavod Malchut. So I want to ask you a couple questions here, guys. Is Yaakov's bowing to Yosef a function of his new Egyptian identity or his Jewishness? And why?
Well, from the Rashi, it would be his Egyptian identity because Paro in the scenario with Moshe and Ahab in the scenario with Eliyahu are not Jewish. And they still respected their king, or the king.
No. Is Yaakov doing this because he's a patriotic Egyptian?
No.
So this is a Jewish thing to do this. How is it a Jewish thing?
Well, like you honor like a head of state. Is that part of it? Is that a Jewish?
Yeah, well, that's what happened. This is the source of it. This is the source.
Oh, this is like when you have an elder or a respected leader in the community that comes in to speak and everyone stands for that person to come in.
Right, but even if the person is an idolatrous king. So with this, okay, so you're saying it's a Jewish principle, not because of which is very interesting because people think that, politics has got nothing to do with Judaism. In every week in many synagogues throughout the world, they will say a prayer on behalf of the king or the president or the queen or whatever the prime minister of the given country they're in. It's the same idea. And if you go in front of, the Queen of England, you bow. And if you go to President Obama or President Trump or whoever the next president will be, you show kavod to them as well. It's a halacha.
Yeah. Well, a couple weeks ago at the White House Hanukkah party, Rabbi Sivalechik from the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, he was a rabbi overseeing that party, and he recited the blessing over the president, over the head of state.
There you go. You see, there's a that idea of there's a bracha for the head of state or for a king shows us that we value the king. And the question is, even if the king is a bad person, because there's no worse person than the king of Egypt, the Paro who enslaved the Jews, wouldn't you say? Yeah, Paro will be Moshe showing honor to him. Now, and I'll further complicate things like this. Question number 7. Why is Yaakov the Navi, the prophet, bowing to his son, Yosef the ruler? Should not honoring your parent and your teacher trump this rule? Remember, the father is bowing to the son. What do you say about that? What about, doesn't Yosef have an obligation to honor his father?
So couldn't they like both bow together, like to each other?
They did not.
They didn't. Okay.
Although Yosef did bow to him at the on the back end. He did bow to him. But it's a good point. So this is also counter to, like, we have an idea of honor that the son has to honor the father, right? Does not the Ten Commandments say that? Kaber davich vatimecha, honor your mother and your father. And there's another obligation, derivative, honoring your main Torah teacher. Because in Yaakov, Yaakov is certainly Yosef's main Torah teacher. And not only that, he's a prophet. He's not just a regular Torah teacher. He's like a super teacher. He's like the master Jedi Knight. He's not just a regular. He's not a Padawan. I saw Star Wars last night. So I'm going to Star Wars. I just want to say I was a little disappointed. By the way, just I don't like to see a movie unless I check up Rotten Tomatoes, see what the scores are. But you had a very big machlokas. The Rotten Tomatoes people, which is all the critics, gave it a 92% score, which is a very high score.
But, I thought it was awesome. Definitely worth a 92.
Right? The poll of the viewers who had saw it, the people who actually were, the regular people, they gave it average out to a 52. So it's one of those movies that the critics love and the people are going, eh. My wife loved it. It was okay. I mean, it's always cool, but a little disappointed. Anyway.
It was a disaster.
Who was that?
Oh, Dave Warshaw.
Dave Warshaw, all right. Welcome. Well, you're with me on that one, right?
It was terrible.
Right. It was, very predictable, All right, and it's also very worn out. Like you have to have the cute little robot thing, cute funny little creature.
Wait. Let's leave BB-8 out of this. He didn't hurt anybody.
He's cute. I mean, I'm not. And first of all, it's 2.5 hours. Don't they have an editor over there? Come on. Anyways, I digress. But I think it's if you leave anything, Dave Warshaw and Rabbi Pinney are on the same thing that gives it a thumbs, sideways to slightly down. But, but again, there's another factor. I was going to see it anyway, because I've already seen every single Star Wars movie in the theater. I'm already in for 9 Star Wars movies. I got to go, They're going to have the last one, the 10th one, and I guess in 2019, I got to see that too, just to close out the series. Anyways. All right, so let's... little digression there.
So I think part of the equation of this bowing could be like Yosef's dream, like to begin with, like everyone bowing to him. Like, so I feel like Yaakov bowing to him is part of the fulfillment of the dream. So I think that's part of this whole equation.
But you see that the Gemara learned from this a universal. The way that you're explaining it, Sean, is that he's doing it because he's the fulfillment of the dream. First of all, they've been living together or reunited for the last 17 years. He's not waiting for the last moment of the 17th year to bow to the guy. So here's not bowing. It seems to be on fulfillment of the dream. It seems to be, they learn from this, the way that Rashi treats it, it's only Yaakov and it's Moshe and it's Eliyahu Navi. Sort of like this is the biblical mandate, how we relate to the king. So I want to get to the thing. So what's the deal with the king? Especially here, we have a situation where even the son, the father, is bowing down to the son. So we have another wild thing. So let's continue on. Sean, read out the, this is insofar as understanding about the rule of law. Mm-hmm. Take out the Rambam's mitzvah, Sefer mitzvah of the 613. Mitzvah 176, take it away.
All right. The 176th mitzvah is that we are commanded to appoint judges to implement the Torah's commands, to force those who have turned away from the path of truth to return to it, to command the performance of good and the avoidance of bad, and to carry out the punishment of transgressors, so that the positive commandments of the Torah and their prohibitions should not be dependent on the desire of every individual.
Okay. In a Jewish society, in a healthy Jewish society, you have an obligation, ideally in Israel, to and even now, to have a court system. Okay? and to that there should be an enforcement and a judgment for all the laws of the Torah. Why? The Rambam gives you a reason, which is self-evident. Why do you need courts, judges, and police, and a judicial system in the Torah system? The Rambam says straight out.
So that the commandments aren't up to you to decide if you're going to obey them or not obey them. They are what they are, and the judges rule that way.
Right. In other words, in America, you have the opposite. In America, everybody is a Jew by choice. And whatever you're going to do as a Jew, you're doing it by choice. You want to keep Shabbos? Great. You don't want to keep Shabbos? Fantastic. You want to keep kosher? Wonderful. You don't want to keep kosher? Great. You know what I mean? It's completely autonomous. Obviously, in a healthy Torah society, you have to have, if the mitzvot are the law of the land, then you can't leave it up to people's if they're in the mood. That doesn't mean that they come along and terrorize people, but the key point, you want to have a consistent system. Now, part of that tool of the judicial system, read on. This is from the Laws of Kings, chapter 1, Halacha 3. Go on.
And as an initial and preferred option, a king may be appointed only by a court of 70 elders, together with a prophet, as Joshua was appointed by Moshe and his court, as Saul and David were appointed by Samuel of Ramah and his court.
Right, so the king of Israel is according to the oral tradition here, is appointed by two offices. One is the office of the prophet, which is in this case Samuel or Moshe, together with his court, his Sanhedrin of 70 elders, including him, so total of 71. Okay, so the king is under, in other words, in Judaism you have checks and balances. So in order to have a king, you got to have a Sanhedrin. The judicial system has to sign off on him. Now, let's keep on going. Let's learn a little more.
The king must be treated with great honor. We must implant awe and fear of him in the hearts of all men. The command in Deuteronomy 17:15, appoint a king, implies that the obligation to be in awe of him. We may not ride on his horse, nor sit on his throne, use his scepter, wear his crown, or use any of his utensils. When he dies, they should all be burned before his coffin.
Okay, so part of what they call kavod malchut, in order that people have great veneration for him, I can't sit in the throne, I can't use his stuff, and then when he passes away, his stuff gets destroyed. Okay, let's go on. Halakha 5, I'm skipping.
Okay. He sits on his throne in his palace and has a crown placed on his head. When he desires, the nation must present themselves before him. They should stand before him and prostrate themselves to the ground. Even a prophet must stand before the king and prostrate himself on the ground, as in Kings, chapter 1 of Kings 1:23 states, "Behold, Nathan, the prophet came before the king and prostrated himself before the king."
Okay, so in other words, everybody, when they come to the king in official hours, has to bow down, even the prophet. So Natan came before him, has to bow before him. Now, ironically, this prophet, Natan, gave stinging rebuke to which famous king about what issue? Anybody remember? Nathan the prophet gave a harsh criticism, rebuke of one of the kings of Israel. Anybody remember? For 500 points in square. So that was actually King David, and he comes and rebukes him about his affair with Bathsheba. So you have two things. On one hand, he's bound to him because he's bound to the office of the king, but does not mean that he does not tell it like it is. Keep on going.
There's one question about that. I thought, like, nowadays, like, we don't bow to, like, anybody, only, like, to, like, Hashem.
It's not a bowing down like we bow, like, on Yom Kippur, all the way flat down. It's more of like a judo bowing, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? In other words, there's a bowing which is within the realm of bowing toward a king,
mm-hmm.
which apparently is distinctive between the flat-out prostration, which we did before Hashem. You know what I'm saying?
Got it.
One is clearly associated with the realm of honor, and one is one before God is showing absolute submission before the Almighty.
So what kind of bowing did Haman want Mordechai to do?
The most extreme version of the royal bow.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted the full, you know, whatever they would bow down to Achashverosh, he wanted for himself.
Okay.
Permishtachavim, you know?
Okay. All right, continuing. Yep. However, a high priest need not come before the king unless the high priest desires to do so. The high priest need not stand before the king. Rather, the king stands before the high priest, as in Numbers 27:21 states, and he shall stand before Eleazar, the priest.
Okay, so it's interesting that the Kohen Gadol doesn't bow to him and doesn't stand to him. Which is it? Well, obviously the question is, what's the difference? Let's keep on going. Let's get all the information and put it into a nice little package, and we'll be done by 9. Let's go.
Nevertheless, it is a mitzvah for the high priest to honor the king by having him seated and standing in his presence when he visits him. The king should only stand before him when he consults the Urim and Tumim.
Right, that's the breastplate, which would be, help him as a tool of providential help to help him communicate to the king, you know, should the Jews attack or not attack, or some of the big national decisions. Okay.
Similarly, it is a mitzvah for the king to honor students of Torah when they enter his presence. He should stand before the Sanhedrin and the sages of Israel and seat them at his side.
Go on. Jehoshaphat.
Right,
Jehoshaphat, or Jehoshaphat.
Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, would follow this practice. Whenever even a student of a Torah scholar would come to him, he would rise from his throne and kiss him and address him as my teacher and master. When does the above apply? When the king is alone in his palace, and then in private before his servants, he should behave in this fashion. However, in public, before the people at large, he should not conduct himself in this manner. He should not stand before anyone. He should not speak gently and should address a person using his name alone in order that the awe of him will be implanted in everyone's hearts.
Okay. All right. Let's figure this all out. So let's explain this. I mean, let me just review everybody and catch all this. So when the king is in public, what's the law? Guys, anybody follow it? When the king's in public and all the people coming into his royal, you know, what's the rule?
They all have to bow.
Everybody's got to bow and everybody's going to act. And he doesn't, and he has to, and he doesn't defer to anybody. They bow to him, they don't bow to them. When he's in private, or just among him and his immediate staff, what does he do, particularly with, Torah scholars or with members of the Sanhedrin?
Well, with a Torah student, the king stands and kisses him and calls him my teacher and master.
Right. So that was an excellent, but at the very least, he stands up and he sits them and they're sitting next to him. You know, they're given tremendous kavod. Yehoshaphat went a step further. He gave everybody a nice hug and kiss and said, my teacher, my master. So privately, he would defer. He would say that he's lower than them. But publicly, he would be the king. And the only person who was an exceptional person who did not have to come was the high priest, which, of course, is, you know, that's the exception. So we have to explain that. So the question is, our question for tonight is, why is the Torah investing so much honor in a human? And why is that different between, if Torah is supreme, which the king shows it privately, but doesn't show it publicly? What's that all about? And then again, the second question is really, what's the deal with the high priest? And lastly, then, how do we deal with political criticism? Is there a place is there a place for political criticism in Judaism? If you have to be so deferential to the kings, that mean you have to camp. Does it mean there's no criticism of the king? All right. So those are a lot of questions. Who wants to take any of them?
Well, I'll take the public versus the private.
Go ahead, Shayna.
The king can't defer to anyone in public because then it shows to the public that there are people who would be higher than the king. And when you're in the public to everybody, you can't show that there's somebody higher than you. You're the top. But in private, when he's just him and that person, then he can show the proper respect that person gets from him.
Okay, that's 100% correct. In other words, the king is elected by the judicial branch, the Sanhedrin, to basically help ruling the Jewish people. That the office of the king has to be viewed as being very significant, because without that, what happens to a society when there is no rule of law?
It falls apart.
Yeah, but like, let's go, like, for example,
it's every man for himself.
Exactly. What does you want to be dropped into areas of Syria where there is no control of the Syrian government and there is no full control of ISIS and there is no control of the rebels? Would you want to be in that part of Syria? What could happen to you there?
You wouldn't be safe.
You would not be safe because basically whoever's got the greater firepower might equals right. And that's it. You're left to the law of the jungle. So the bottom line is, and I didn't even put the source on, and, you know, I want to put too many sources on the page, but Pirkei Avos says something very beautiful. It says, pray for the king, because without him, each man would swallow up his friend. Which basically means that without the rule of law, even a not great rule of law, even Pharaoh, even Ahab, even anybody, even Trump, is better than no rule of law. So we're honoring not the individual, but the institution of the leader, because society desperately needs that, okay? So privately, he can show kavod to the great Torah sage, because he is objectively a superior. But as far as government and rule of law, he has to do that. Going back to our subject, Yaakov Avinu, even though Yosef is his son, what he is demonstrating is that he is bowing not to Yosef as an individual, but Yosef as qua ruler, the office of the ruler of the country. And he's showing that as being a very important thing. It's vital for society that there should be a rule of law, a respect for law, and a respect for the authority. Now, where does that put in? Now, so are we, is the Torah endorsing tyrants? Here's my 500 points in the square. Where in the Chumash do we see that the Jewish people forcefully brought up a criticism against their leader and they were correct and the leader was punished?
I do not know that one.
Okay, so the leader is Moshe. The people are the Jewish people, and they're in the desert, and they complain to Moshe, Manishteh, what will we drink? And they're very forceful about that. And Moshe gets angry at them. He says, "Mamre Mayisem, you've been rebels." All right? This is where the whole the hitting the rock thing goes down. And ultimately, Moshe gets punished for his unjust criticism of the Jewish people, so much so that the punishment is he's no longer allowed to lead them anymore. So here's a key punchline. The reality is we're all about proper and respectful, just criticism. We balance that we want there to be an authority. We want the vitality of the authority figure. There's a value for society. And we can't give in to the childish emotion that we don't want to have any authority. Because without any authority, you end up with a place like Syria where basically the biggest injustices occur to people. You know, they're right now still finding bodies in the terrible when the United States and the Allied forces, together with the Iraqi army, was taking back from ISIS the town of, what's it called?
Raqqa?
No, the other one.
Capital? Aleppo?
No, not that one. I'm blanking on the name. It was a year long war. But basically, because of the injustices done, more civilians died than actual fighters. And when you have tremendous, you know, when you have no rule, it results in tremendous, tremendous bloodshed. Now, obviously, you can have tremendous bloodshed with the rule of law. I mean, the Nazis would be a good example of that. So, but assuming a person's not tyrannical, there's still a value of even a slightly unjust ruler than no rule of law. That's a disaster. And Yaakov, even though that he was sick, he was exhausted, he's on his last day, he gets up because he wants to demonstrate that the ruler of the country deserves kavod. Even if that person is his son, who should be honoring him? Even though that person is a student and should be honoring him. Nope. Well, simultaneously does not mean that we don't engage in proper tochacha, in rebuke, appropriate criticism. Even though that Nathan the prophet bowed before King David, he accused King David of a tremendous sin by sleeping with Bathsheba. All right? Two separate things. So I can show honor to your office, but I can criticize your deeds. Do you understand the balance here? So mocking is not a Jewish value. Political satire would be a value if it's within a reasonable, thoughtful dialogue and, you know, healthy disagreement. We see in the Talmud that the arguments between the various Torah scholars was vicious, but it was not against the person. It was about in the world. It was a battle for ideas. Okay. You know, they would say they would battle, you know, like a war, but it would end with love because they loved each other. But as far as the getting the most pure, truthful idea out there, that they had to be as powerful as they could. And that's the basic idea. So for us personally, we have to recognize that there's a value and importance of an authority figure to help govern a society, govern a community, govern an institution, valuable. But does not mean that we don't criticize, appropriately when we see something wrong done. We just don't allow our emotional satisfaction of mocking people just so I can feel better about myself. That we don't do. We don't say Lashon Hara. We don't say negative information, which has no value. We don't slander people, libel people, certainly, which is made up, a terrible thing. We don't embarrass people. So we would not have in a terror society a late night show where the person just, in a vicious or aggressive way, attack a sitting president, whether it be Republican or Democrat. It would not, It's not a Jewish value at all. So, and it's not productive because you don't, you know, as Suzanne said very nicely, in other words, both visions are not, are incorrect. Not that Donald Trump does nothing wrong, and it's also not correct that Donald Trump never does anything right. Both are incorrect. But if you have such an aggressive dialogue and it's vicious and it's a virulent attack, no truth comes out. And that's where it's, we're interested in the truth and protecting institutions which will safeguard the society. That's the institution of what we call Kavod Malchut, the honor of the king. And that's the basic idea. And you see that Yaakov himself is on his deathbed, still does it. So from that we learn, we show tremendous kavod for the office of the king or office of the leader. And that's the basic idea. Any questions?
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah, shoot.
One, should Joseph have also like bowed at the same time? Like, would that have been the ideal scenario?
He bowed at the end.
So that was sufficient? Okay. Yeah. And then what about protesting, like a king? Like people who are like out protesting Trump or any other king or like head of state, is that also frowned upon in Torah Judaism?
I mean, the question is, in other words, if it's a civil protest, yeah, that's fine. Whatever is in the realm of, you know, effective. The question is, there's protesting, there's protesting. But that's not really, I mean, that's not the ideal way. The ideal way is to gain, real dialogue.
You know? Right, intellectual criticism, right.
Yeah, that's our starting point. Yeah. Or write an article, you know, let's say criticizing a policy, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's a Jewish way.
Okay.
And without criticizing the person, if they're fat, if they're small, if they're short, if they do this or that. Now again, I'm clearly not endorsing any political person. I'm just giving sort of the principle behind it. Go on.
Okay, and last question is just a question about the Parsha that wasn't what we talked about, but I think is relevant. When Yaakov is on his like deathbed, and he's talking to Yosef, he like asked to basically for like Yosef's sons to like be his. I thought that was very confusing. Is that a misreading of it or don't
understand? He says he basically rewards Yosef by saying that your sons are going to be treated as my sons when it comes to the distribution of land in the land of Israel. Basically, he's making Yosef the de facto firstborn. So now Yosef is now turning to two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, and they now take two possible tribes, even though Yosef is one guy. There should be just Sheva Yosef. There is not. There's Sheva Ephraim and Sheva Manasseh. So he's giving him a double portion. It's a reward for him electing him to being the firstborn.
Okay, so it's a reward. It's not like he was like taking the
son. No, he was rewarding. He was saying that you are de facto the firstborn, even though that Reuven and Shimon, and he basically articulates why basically Reuven, Shimon, Levi are essentially fired from the leadership role. We talked about that at, last year on the Parsha. We could check out that class. But he's giving part of his saying that Yosef, you're the leader. You're now the firstborn. You're going to get a double portion, and therefore your sons are going to be viewed as my sons, and therefore they're going to each get a portion of the land of Israel. Instead of being just the tribe of Yosef, there's now two tribes, tribe of Ephraim and tribe of Manasseh.
Got it. Okay.
All right, guys.
I got a question. I got a question.
Oh. Yeah.
Is too late? Okay.
No, go.
So So just to sum up, because I apologize, I came a little late to the call. So bottom line is you got to respect the office of the president and in order to respect the rule of law.
Yep.
And if you're going to criticize, and you're in front of the president, you can criticize him in private, just not in public. That seems to be the main gist, right?
So the key point is that your summary is on point. You can you will criticize a person again privately where it's effective, or you can write an article or wherever it's clearly objectively with the interest of criticizing the policy without undermining the entire office of the king or the president.
Right. Okay. So I guess my question then is, now that I wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything there. Yeah. If a group of people or an individual feels though that the president is deeply immoral, and I'm not one of these, I hate Trump. I have no problem with him. I'm not for him. I'm not against him.
Okay.
I'm actually pleasantly surprised.
Okay.
So, but that's kind of irrelevant, right? But at the end of the day, there are people who feel, he's evil, like he's a Russia,
right,
and that his policies will cause harm.
Right.
And at what point, would Judaism say, hey, we do need to fight this person in whatever means necessary, not to compare, but what was the right response for Hitler, right? I mean, you could argue terrorism would make sense, right? So how would you tackle that?
So, excellent question. So there clearly is a line where when somebody is such a evil tyrant, where their pulse, where their presence as being head of state is so horrible for the people, you got to do whatever you can to get the person out of office. There is a point. Now, one of our benefits that we live in a democratic society, and there are legal method to the person is really acting unjustly. So the fact that there is an independent, there's an independent, investigation or prosecution, did the Trump administration on the ramp up to the election collude with the government of Russia or not? So we'll see. If yes, yes. If no, no. So therefore, if we have a independent investigation, and let's see what happens. That's the right way of dealing with it. I mean, say in this case, you know what I'm saying? But you can get situations like we have, like in Venezuela. You have, a leader who's really hurting the people, and is tyrannical. So you got to figure out whatever you can to try to get the guy out. There would be a
plan
to support a coup, for example.
Right. Well, let me ask you that. I mean, this might be more kind of off the beaten path, but do I have a chiv to kill him? Right. Let's say I'm a Venezuelan citizen.
Right.
Right. And I know the guy there is a dictator and he's causing my family to starve to death. I mean, do I have a chiv to just try to shoot him if I can?
So in general, Judaism is basically against, vigilantism, and things have to be done through a juridical way. So we're not taking the law in our hands. But let's say you would support an opposing figure. That would, let's say there's going to be a, let's say the general is going to do a coup to support him. I don't think we're becoming, I don't see the justification of becoming like the assassin to knock the guy off. Now, obviously, you always have the Hitler fantasy, like the old question, if you saw Hitler in 1940 or 1939, you had a clear shot, would you take it? You know what I mean? So maybe in that case, I would. So, but that's like the most extreme circumstance. But for your garden variety tyrant, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so. But that's a good question.
I just think that the people who hate Trump and they do mock him, it's with venom, right? Because they really hate him. And they think he's so evil and immoral. So when you think like that, I can understand why they do it,
Correct. It's right. He engenders a level of aggression that's not been seen against any president that I can remember or know historically. So correct. Right. So that's right. And that could happen. That could happen. You know, it wouldn't not be shocking, you know what I mean? That somebody takes a shot at the guy. I'm not wishing upon him, you know. But yes, there are people who feel that he's the modern Hitler, 100%. Which I don't think is a just depiction of the guy. I'm not saying I want him to be my best friend, but that's not really an accurate depiction. All right, man. If you guys tomorrow night at MJE.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.